Good morning, everyone. We are ready to get started. All right. Thank you all. I apologize for the delay. We always have some hurdles to jump through sometimes here in the M17, M18 room with internet connectivity. But I'm really glad to see that everyone here in person has been chatting and networking. And I hope that you who are joining us online have been doing so as well. So welcome. My name is Julie McCarty, and I'm a knowledge management specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. And welcome to our February Ag Sector Council seminar entitled, Are Farmers Willing to Pay for Drought-Tolerant Rice? Evidence from Bihar and Other Policy Research Priorities for Cereal Farming Systems in South Asia. This happens to be the third Ag Sector Council in a row for which we've had some sort of snow delay or closing. So we've been a little bit cursed this winter, but we've been delighted to have a steady following, especially of our online participants. So thank you all for being here today. The basic housekeeping issues, please remember to silence your cell phones. But if you are a Twitter aficionado, please do feel free to use those cell phones, or if you're joining online, to tweet. And our hashtag is AgEvents, which is up here on the screen. For the online participants, please feel free to share your Twitter handles, your networking contacts, your personal or professional websites. We love to see that sort of networking going on. And last but not least, we are recording this session, so we'll have it posted on AgriLinks in about a week and make sure to send the recording to all of you. And part of the implication of recording is using the microphone to help us get everything recorded. So when you're asking a question, please remember to state your name and to just wait until someone's passed you one of these handheld mics to make sure that that's recorded. So without further ado, I will pass the mic on to John McMurdy, who is our International Research and Biotechnology Advisor at the Bureau for Food Security. And he's been great in helping getting this particular session set up. So thank you, John.
Thanks, Julie, and thanks, everyone, for making it in this morning. I think for once we can be proud to be in D.C., that we didn't shut down the government with a little bit of snow. So good for us that we pursued. I think this is another good opportunity to highlight the work we do in sustainable intensification, highlight the work we've been doing for a little more than 5 years now in South Asia with the program called the Cereal Systems Initiative for South Asia. David's going to talk a little bit more about the kind of some of the overarching themes of the program, but I think it's probably safe to say that we've used the model that's been developed by CISA as a data to inform many of our other new sustainable intensification programs. So I think it's really been kind of at the forefront of our thinking about how we approach some of these challenges. And I say that to mean that it's not just it's really a focus on a comprehensive program. It's not just a breeding program. It's not just an agronomic research program. It's not just a policy research program. It is really an activity that synthesizes those all into one sort of coherent activity. So I think what you'll hear today is a very interesting example about how we make the case for more private sector involvement. So maybe to step back a second. So we've talked a lot. You've probably heard in the past 6, 7, 8 months now, maybe even longer, about the scaling of technologies. You've heard Dr. Shaw talk about the scaling of technologies. You have Andy, who was in the room, was leading our scaling effort for quite a while. And as we know, we're not going to get to scale without the real heavy involvement of the private sector, the heavy involvement of industry, to mean local industry and international industry. And I think a lot of the questions that the policy side of the CISA program are looking to answer are, what are those business opportunities? What's going to be an opportunity for an entrepreneur? What's going to hold up the ability to really push innovation and scale it? And then a lot of this research, the policy research under CISA, looks at answering some of those primary questions. So I think that'll be a bit of what you get today from David and Patrick. And I think the addition to that is a lot of this work can really inform governments, of where are very discrete policy opportunities, where are very discrete areas where, frankly, they're getting in the way, or frankly, they could make technologies more scalable, release some of these barriers to adoption. So another kind of discrete goal. And third, certainly the interest in rice technologies for us. This is an area where we have a lot of investment, USAID, the U.S. government, in South Asia, in developing a lot of new rice technologies. Hybrid rice, a lot of work on abiotic stress tolerance, both through conventional and advanced breeding methods. So this is a pretty important question to us. We're spending all this money developing these technologies, but are farmers willing to pay for it, pay for drought tolerance, pay for hybrid? So it's a pretty fundamental question that, you know, hopefully you would have thought to ask earlier on, but we're asking this question now, and I think it's an important one. My last comment before I stop yammering up here would be, I've heard David give some of these talks before, and I really find it kind of interesting, not being an economist, but the way that these things are set up. I very much find it to, I don't know how to describe it, cool economics, maybe. I don't know, maybe there's an uncool economics, but this is definitely cool economics, and from the engineer side in me, I think it's pretty fascinating. So with that, I'll turn it over to our speakers. Maybe I'll introduce both of you guys, and then David, you're going to go first. Yeah. So David Spielman is a senior research fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, where he focuses on agricultural science policy, seed systems, and community-driven development. David previously was based in Addis, and earlier in his career, he's worked on development topics for the World Bank, Aga Khan Development Network in Pakistan, and several other organizations. He has his PhD in economics from American, master's from the London School of Economics, and BA from International Relations from Tufts University, and is a son of a USAID guy, I believe, if I remember correctly. And Patrick Ward is an associate research fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute. He's based in New Delhi, India. His research focuses on policy and behavioral issues related to risk management and new agricultural technologies and practices to promote the sustainable intensification of cereal systems in the Indo-Gangetic Plains of South Asia. Patrick has his PhD in agricultural economics from Purdue, and before this was a visiting researcher with the International Center for Climate Governance in Venice, Italy. So, great. I'll turn it over to David then.
So the work we're going to present to you today was conducted under the auspices of the Cereal Systems Initiative for South Asia. CISA's overarching goal is to increase food, nutrition, and income security at scale in a feasible manner in South Asia through sustainable intensification of its cereal-based systems. So the project spans from the Punjab of India and partly Pakistan across the Indo-Gangetic Plain to Haryana, Uttar Pradesh, on over to Bihar. You go down into northern Bangladesh and southern Bangladesh, which is the Feed the Future zone, as well as the Indian state of Odisha. There are some notable states that are left out in that sort of geography, Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, and West Bengal, among others. Nonetheless, this entire area is, you know, what we refer to as the Indo-Gangetic Plain, or plains, and it's an area where wheat, rice wheat systems, rice, other crop systems, and rice systems are prevalent, and it's an intensively cropped area. I think many of you have either worked there or are familiar with it. It is in parts, especially in the northwest, the breadbasket of South Asia, but a lot of that production is shifting or will shift eastwards, towards places like Bihar, towards places like the eastern side of Uttar Pradesh, that are relatively underdeveloped in terms of infrastructure, in terms of productivity, in terms of technology. So these are areas where we're focusing in on, Odisha, southern Bangladesh, and other areas. So, like I said, it's being implemented right now in three countries. There are two donors to this project. USAID is one of them. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is our second donor. We've completed the first phase of this work, which was really, I think, exploratory, setting up a sense of what technologies we're going to focus in on. I've presented in the past with my colleagues on laser land leveling, one of the CISA technologies that is particularly interesting. In phase two, we're scaling up a lot of this work and reaching a large number of farmers and still doing some very good, I think, adaptive research. The impact challenge is obvious, catalyzing durable change with millions of small and medium-scale farmers. The scale is enormous, the challenge is enormous, and figuring out just how to do it through a blend of good systems agronomy, crop breeding, policy change or policy reform, and private sector investment along with the public sector seems to be the way we have to put things together to make this happen. I should point out that the project is motivated in part by USAID's own sort of larger portfolio of investments in agricultural development and sustainable intensification in smallholder systems. So what we're talking about today, drought-tolerant rice cultivars, really plays into USAID's own sort of long-standing portfolio of investment in ag research. This is the portfolio that I'm sure some of you know and may have been involved in that brought herbicide-resistant sorghum in West Africa. It brought out the BT eggplant, the insect-resistant transgenic eggplant in India that's recently been released in Bangladesh, not only with technologies but also with better policies. Policy research is one of several components of this big project, and this sort of umbrella project, if you will. And the idea is that better public policies are needed to improve the prospects for agricultural technology development and dissemination, private investment in agricultural inputs and services and technologies, and ultimately public-private partnerships that focus in on small and medium-sized farmers. Science alone, we argue, is insufficient. And our research agenda at IFPRI focuses in on two particular issues. The first is encouraging private investment and these partnerships in ProPort technology development and delivery. And the other one is looking at, and especially in our second phase, this issue of changing labor, gender, assets, and migration dynamics. So there's a lot of change going on in South Asia right now. A lot of men have moved to the cities, to the construction sector. You know, a lot of rural labor has if not disappeared, has started to sort of contract. There's a lot of feminization of farm work, farm labor, and these dynamics are creating a lot of change. And understanding exactly how you deal with those things. I mean, is it all about labor-saving mechanization? Is it all about, you know, cultivars that are resistant to abiotic stress? I mean, there's so many different things going on. Understanding those dynamics and not falling back on sort of the priors we all have about what Asian agriculture is or South Asian agriculture is, it's really important, bringing new evidence. So over the last 4 years, we've done a lot under CISA. We've been very busy. We've had a great time doing it as well. And I can roughly categorize the work we've done on policy reform issues into three areas. One are seeds, traits, and fertilizer. So we've looked at a host of issues, sorry for the microphone, such as industry structure in the seed and biotechnology sector. We've looked at the role of hybrid rice, which we're going to talk about in the context of this study. We've looked at stress tolerance traits in both Odisha and Bihar. And we're looking more at fertilizer now and how farmers deal with balanced fertilizer use recommendations. We're really interested, like I said, in this machinery and equipment aspect. There's a lot of scope for mechanization in South Asian agriculture, like I said, because there's a labor shortage in many areas. If so, what are the appropriate types of mechanization, especially with respect to machinery that can help conserve resources as well as increase productivity or yields on farm? And we're looking at various crop management and risk management mechanisms, such as the combination between weather index insurance and things like drought and flood tolerant cultivars. So that gives you a scope of all the different things we do and are doing. We'll be working on this for the next several years and continue to amass data. We present and interact with policymakers throughout South Asia. It's not an easy task. Policy change is a very complex process. An evidence-based narrative that we provide to policymakers and decision makers in the private sector is only one element that influences the decisions they make. With that in mind, I want to turn it over to my colleague, Patrick, and he'll go through sort of what we've learned about drought-tolerant rice in Bihar from a choice experiment, and he'll give you a sense of the issues we're dealing with in more detail. Thanks.
As David mentioned, the remainder of the talk today is going to focus on one particular study that we have done as part of IFPRI's contributions to the Cereal Systems Initiative for South Asia. The overall question that was driving this research is, you know, are farmers willing to pay for drought-tolerant rice? As John mentioned, something that has received a lot of interest, and so we kind of took it upon ourselves to look at the feasibility of a drought-tolerant, both drought-tolerant cultivar and a drought-tolerant hybrid within the context of a particular state in India, Bihar, which is one of the poorest and least developed states in the entire country. So we had a couple of primary objectives that we were looking at when we undertook this study. First, we wanted to estimate the demand for drought-tolerant rice using a method known as discrete choice experiments, and I'll explain more about that method as we move forward. One of the nice things about this method is it allows you to decompose a seed into its various traits. Not necessarily a seed. It allows you to decompose a particular good or commodity into its various traits and then evaluate how the consumer, or in this case the farmer, feels or values each of these different characteristics. Using a statistical method, we were able to then look at how tastes and preferences vary across population. And then ultimately, we wanted to analyze the potential for both public and private sector involvement in the research, development, and delivery of ProPort technologies. As you know, both John and David have mentioned, one of the only ways that a technology like this can really be scalable is if we have private sector involvement. To date, most of the work that has been done by public sector or even international research organizations. But there is, you know, a lot of interest in seeing the private sector get involved. Private sector is generally more efficient and able to bring things to scale at a much more rapid and sustainable rate than the public sector. So this raises an interesting issue. How do we combine the efforts to incentivize the private sector with the efforts to reach small-scale, resource-poor farmers, which is ultimately our primary objective in bringing about these kind of technologies? And there are a couple of examples of how this has been done in the past. One would be humanitarian use exemptions, where the public sector has been able to get a hold of private sector property rights and use them to specifically target disadvantaged groups. Another would be technology subsidies, where the public sector funds are given to the private sector to produce a technology that can be specifically targeted towards specific groups. Technology embodiment, in which you embody the technology in a product that only appeals to certain disadvantaged groups. And then finally, market segmentation, where you're able to build marketing strategies that are explicitly able to target specific groups. And these are just a few examples of how each of these different strategies have been used in the past. So our particular study is interested in a particular type of abiotic stress tolerance. We're particularly interested in drought tolerance. So this, you know, I just want to take a few seconds to describe the problem of droughts and rice production in Bihar. You know, droughts are a significant constraint to rice production. Rice is very heavily dependent upon water. And India in particular has a lot of areas that are particularly sensitive to low water environments. India has 22.3 million hectares of what might be classified as unfavorable areas. This includes 3 million hectares of upland rice and 16 million hectares of rain-fed lowland rice. And these rain-fed lowland rice areas are really, really particularly sensitive to droughts and are an area in which a drought-tolerant technology could potentially be transformative. 20% of India's total rice area is drought-prone. And then the evidence suggests that droughts have significant effects, evidence suggests that droughts have been occurring with greater frequency in India and around the world. And so if this trend is going to continue, then it's possible that droughts will occur with even greater frequency, even greater severity going forward, which just highlights the scope for a technology of this sort. So this figure shows periods of drought and total rice production in India dating back to the early 1960s. So since the early 1960s, there have been a total of 15 times where rice production on a year-over-year basis has failed to exceed that from the previous year. And as you can see from these graphs, the majority of these occurrences have happened to coincide with serious droughts in several key rice-growing regions of India. These gray bars representing different drought periods. So we can see that a lot of times where we have these downward drops, they coincide with drought occurrences. Now, there are a couple of reasons why droughts can affect total rice production. One is that there is generally a decline in area cultivated under rice. So as we can see here, dating back to 1999-2000, in several of these years in which there have been droughts, there have been significant declines in the area devoted to rice production. It's also the case that whenever droughts occur, there is a decline in rice yields. Again, we see a similar trend. Whenever there is a drought, there is usually a decline in yields from one year to the next. So there are definitely implications of droughts for rice production. There are also secondary social consequences of droughts. Droughts often result in lower farm incomes, since farmers generally have lower marketable surpluses that they can sell to the market. There are also higher prices for consumers. Lower supply in the market means a higher price at the market. Farmers are also forced to increase indebtedness or deplete their productive asset base as they try to smooth consumption due to their lower farm incomes. This can result in, you know, higher incidences of poverty and malnutrition. And there's increasing evidence that shows that even when droughts do not occur, the risk of a drought, the background risk of a drought, can force farmers or compel farmers to take less than optimal investments or use lower than optimal inputs, which then sort of traps them into a low productivity environment. Now, in this low productivity environment, or in this context where droughts pose these significant risks, a product like DT rice could potentially provide a means for reducing the risk, avoiding the increasing threats of droughts. One thing we should note about DT rice is that we consider it a productivity-enhancing technology rather than necessarily a productivity-increasing technology. And the distinction is that productivity-enhancing implies that the variability of yields is reduced rather than simply increasing the expected value. Now, in many cases, and in the particular case of Sabaki Dan, it actually is able to perform quite well under normal conditions, so there's not a yield penalty, while maintaining its yield under conditions of drought. So this Sabaki Dan was developed by the International Rice Research Institute. In India, it's marketed as Sabaki Dan. In Bangladesh, it's marketed as Biri Dan 56. It has a different name in Nepal where it is marketed. It was released in India in 2009. In the first two states were Jharkhand and Odisha. Sabaki Dan is tolerant under drought stress, so it's able to maintain advantages over Czech varieties in rain-fed, drought-affected conditions. So the Czech varieties that it's compared to here are IR36 and IR64, and it maintains a yield advantage of 29% and 19% over these Czech varieties under drought stress conditions. And as I mentioned, there's no yield penalty under normal conditions. In fact, Sabaki Dan actually performs better than these Czech varieties under normal conditions. So this all sounds great, right? You got a DT variety that outperforms the Czech varieties under normal conditions, but also performs better under drought stress conditions. There are a couple of challenges to DT adoption, one of which is that some researchers have argued that it may not necessarily perform better than other varieties under normal conditions. You know, I've mentioned that this particular variety outperforms IR64 and IR36 under normal conditions, but those are just two varieties, and there's a lot of other varieties in the area, and this particular variety might not outperform those under normal conditions. So in that case, farmers might not observe the benefits of this variety relative to other varieties that they may grow. The same thing can be said under extreme stress levels. If the drought is severe enough, then the benefits of the drought-tolerant variety basically comes to zero, and it performs just as poorly as the non-DT variety. So it seems as though moderate drought stress levels is the optimal level by which you can observe the benefits of the DT relative to the other varieties. Now, the thing is, you don't observe a moderate drought stress level every year. And so this complicates the learning about the benefits of the technology relative to the non-drought tolerant variety. And the way technologies are primarily disseminated, at least in, you know, the way we talk about it in the economics literature, is you either learn from doing yourself or you learn from others. And with a situation where you don't observe the benefits on a year-in, year-out basis, it's difficult to learn from your own experiences and also difficult to learn from the experiences of others. So these challenges may affect the dissemination of drought-tolerant technologies. It can also constrain the demand for drought-tolerant technologies. To estimate the demand for drought-tolerant technologies, we use a methodology known as discrete choice experiments. These are hypothetical choice scenarios in which respondents are forced to choose among a series of hypothetical alternatives. These are designed to ascertain how farmers evaluate different choice alternatives. We're able to decompose their preferences for alternatives into how they value each of the characteristics that are embodied in a particular alternative. We can use, because these are hypothetical, we can use these to evaluate preferences for goods that are not yet on market or that do not have functioning markets. These are used a lot of times for things like environmental amenities, things that are difficult to value in a market setting. But the nice thing about this is that it closely simulates real-world purchasing decisions. So you can force people to behave as though they were engaging in an actual market. So this is an example of a choice task that is used in a discrete choice experiment. For those in the audience, one of these on your seats this morning, and for those that are participating over the web, this should be available on the event page. So this is in English, but the actual choice sets that we used during our survey were translated into Hindi so that the respondents could actually look at it and read it for themselves. But what this does is describes a series of hypothetical bundles of randomly varying seed characteristics. And the characteristics that we included were the duration, and this is the length of time from seed bed preparation to harvest. The yield, and this is in munds per acre, and a mund is a local unit of mass equivalent to 40 kilograms. We included an attribute for whether the grain can be stored and reused as seed next season. This is a characteristic that captures the economic value of hybrids. We included the seed price, because this allows us to have a monetary measure for willingness to pay. And then an attribute known as the seeding rate, and this is the amount of seed that is required per acre of land in order to attain a full plot. So each one of these characteristics is then broken into three different alternatives. We have seed option A, seed option B, seed option C, plus a status quo option. Farmers could simply revert back to the seed that they used during the previous season. Now, by having these different options with these different combinations of attributes, and different levels of these attributes, it forces the consumer to evaluate, just looking at these different options, which one of these four alternatives they would prefer the most. So, for example, option A is a long-duration variety. Farmers might say, oh, I don't really want a long-duration variety, so they might just block out all of option A and focus on option B, C, or their current seed, option D. Maybe they'll look at option C and say, oh, it's a short-duration variety. I like short-duration variety. It allows me to escape perhaps an early monsoon withdrawal. But this only yields 50 munds per acre under normal or irrigated conditions and yields only 16 munds per acre under a severe drought condition. Plus, I can't save my seed and reuse it for next season. So maybe I don't like option C, even though it is only 25 rupees. Maybe I like option B, which is a medium duration variety, high yielding under normal conditions, maintains its yield advantage under moderate severe stress conditions. I can save it and reuse it next season, even if it does cost me 140 rupees per kilo. So this just helps farmers to think through what their decision-making process is. We collect information on their particular choice, as well as secondary information about what was their thought process, what factors led to them making a particular decision. Were there any factors that they ignored while making their decision? Which just helps us to understand more comprehensively the actual decision-making process. At the same time, we also conducted some experiments meant to measure farmers' preferences towards risk and potential losses. The handouts that were on your seat this morning, if you flip over to the back side, these contain a couple of these experiments that can be used to measure risk and loss aversion. Now, the way these work is they are a series of hypothetical lotteries. In each case, farmers were able to choose option A, which in some cases is a certain payment, or option B, which is a lottery that has a potentially high payment and a potentially low payment. In the second experiment, towards the bottom of that page, both option A and option B are lotteries. Option A is a winning payment, which has a positive sum in both cases, and option B is a losing payment, which has a negative sum. Based on farmers' responses to each of these two games, we were able to gauge quantitatively a measure for their degree of risk aversion and loss aversion. This is really important because it allows us to characterize different farmers and see whether or not their preferences for drought tolerance is driven by their underlying behavioral characteristics, such as risk aversion and loss aversion. As I mentioned, this study was conducted in Bihar, India. As David was alluding to before, CESA operates in much of the Indo-Gangetic Plain, which starts up here in Punjab and Haryana, moves down across Uttar Pradesh into Bihar, and then into Bangladesh. It also covers the Terai Belt of Nepal. But this is the state of Bihar. As I mentioned before, it's one of the poorest and most underdeveloped states in Bihar. We randomly sampled farmers from three heavily dependent rice-producing districts: Madhubani, which is the north bordering Nepal; Bhojpur, which is kind of central west, right along the Ganga River; and Nevada, which is in the south. So these three districts provide a great deal of geographic heterogeneity. There's also a great deal of economic heterogeneity. Bhojpur is one of the wealthiest districts in the state. Nevada is also rather wealthy. Both Bhojpur and Nevada have high rice productivity. Madhubani is one of the poorest districts and has very low rice productivity. But all three districts are considered drought-prone. Bhojpur was part of India's drought-prone area program up until 2010, and Madhubani and Nevada are both part of the drought-prone area program as of 2010 into the present. This map shows rainfall deficiencies during the 2012 Kharif season. That's the monsoon season in India, which starts from about the beginning of July and goes till about the end of September. And this shows rainfall deficiency deviations from long-term averages. And as we can see, these three districts both experienced really significant rainfall deficiencies during 2012. Bhojpur, 32% below average; Madhubani, 48% below average; and Nevada, 49% below average. So they, you know, are very familiar with experiencing droughts. They know the effect that droughts can have on their total production. And so this was going to be fresh on their mind and would hopefully be really informative into their decision-making process. So I know this figure is maybe a little bit confusing, so I'm going to take a little bit of time to explain what's going on here. This figure shows farmers' average median willingness to pay for each of the different rice attributes. We included six types of yield attributes, varying combinations of yields under the different rainfall conditions. So these are listed across the bottom here, these six: inbred 1, 2, 3, hybrid 1, 2, 3. And then we consider things like the duration, and then whether the seed can be reused. I realized that I mistakenly left off the valuation for the seeding rate, but I can discuss the results of that. What these figures show are these dark lines represent the mean willingness to pay. The boxes show interquartile ranges. These kind of tails show the min and the max, excluding outliers, and then the circles show the outliers. So what we can see from this is that there is generally a really significant and positive willingness to pay for these higher drought-tolerant yields. There's a great deal of variation for the yields corresponding to the hybrid seeds, much less variation for the yields corresponding to the inbred seeds. We also see that on average there is a negative willingness to pay for the process of having to buy new seeds every year. This is fairly consistent with what one might expect. There's a trade-off between having to buy new seeds every year, which is generally an attribute of hybrids, with the higher yields that you're able to attain through hybridization. And then there's a positive but much smaller willingness to pay for short and medium duration relative to long duration. So we do find that farmers prefer short duration more than long duration, and they're willing to pay more for shorter duration than they are for something that is a medium duration. We also see, you know, kind of as I alluded to, there's wide variation in farmers' preferences for the different seed characteristics. These figures show how the distribution of valuations change when we incorporate things like risk preferences. And what we see is that when we control for risk and loss aversion, these distributions all shift to the right, which means that as we incorporate things like risk aversion into studying the farmer's valuation, we actually see that it increases the way farmers perceive these different. And these are just for the yield distributions. When we look at the other attributes, we actually find that there is no effect of incorporating risk aversion. So it's really interesting that when we include risk aversion in our analysis, we see that increases the valuation that farmers place for these drought-tolerant yield distributions. We can also, maybe it's a little bit difficult to see this dashed line here. Can everybody see that okay? Okay. We can also bundle the willingness to pay for each of the individual attributes and get what might be the willingness to pay for different hypothetical seeds. So in this case, we took characteristics for a drought-tolerant hybrid and compared them with the willingness to pay for a drought cultivar very similar to Erie Sabaki Don. And we were able to trace out demand curves for these two hypothetical seed bundles. Actually, the one that's listed as inbred is actually a real seed bundle. Those are the characteristics of Sabaki Don. But we were able to trace out the demand curves for a hypothetical DT hybrid and compare that with the demand curve for something like Sabaki Don. And we see there's a great deal, very, very different structure for demand between the two products. Demand for the DT hybrid is much less sensitive to price. So if you adjust the price, you know, even by a relatively large amount, you're not going to see a huge increase in either the area of land covered by the seed or the quantity of seed demanded. There's much greater sensitivity for something like a DT cultivar, where particularly in this region here, a small increase in price can lead to a significant increase in the area of land that's covered. One thing that's interesting about this is that there is this group of farmers here and group of farmers here who either really like the DT cultivar or really dislike the DT cultivar. These may correspond to the same farmers that really like the DT hybrid and really dislike the DT hybrid. But it's really quite interesting that there's just this huge like straight line on both ends of this curve. So some general observations that we can take away from this. As I alluded to, the demand for the DT hybrid far less sensitive to price, so a reduction in the DT hybrid is not likely to have a large effect on DT hybrid demand. There are significant differences in the demand structure for these two. Demand for the DT hybrid reveals a much greater degree of variation in preferences among the different farmers. The DT hybrid or DT inbred does vary a great deal. For a large portion of this figure, the willingness to pay varies within a very narrow band. The fact that there are these different demand structures suggests that there is potential natural market segmentation. You have a group of farmers that really like the DT hybrid, and are willing to pay significant premium for that, which suggests that there is, you know, a potential market for private sector to take advantage of. And yet there's a large portion of the population that would not be willing to pay a premium for the DT hybrid, which suggests a potential market for a DT cultivar like Sabaki-Don. So as we say here, there's a role for both public and private sector involvement in the delivery and development, discovery, delivery and development of DT seeds. So overall takeaways, we definitely found that farmers in our sample really liked the reduction in yield variability that were conferred by these hypothetical DT seeds. They were willing to pay significantly more than what they are generally currently paying for seeds, as we see from this figure here. I mean, the willingness to pay, you know, for some farms all the way up to almost 700 rupees. This is significantly more than farmers are currently paying for many of their seeds. But they're willing to pay the most for seeds that not only offer reduced yield variability during times of drought, but also perform better during normal conditions as well. Not completely surprising, farmers you know, are risk averse, but they also like to have yields under normal conditions. There were a significant segment of the market that values the yields and lower seeding rates for the DT hybrid. Yeah, which suggests that, as I alluded to before, that the market for a DT hybrid and a DT could definitely coexist. This also suggests that there is, you know, the role for potentially public-private partnerships that could develop these DT hybrids and DT cultivars simultaneously to reach more resource-poor smallholder farmers in Bihar. Thank you.